Mr. Duncan, Reel 9. So you moved to Malta?
Malta. Yeah, that's, as I say, that was the... I, for the first time now, I experienced and enjoyed normal civilian peacetime garrison life in Malta, whereby it was... you had time for sporting activities throughout the garrison, football competitions and boxing competitions, visits, social visits to each other's mess, and plenty of time for training your arm, in this case, load our cat.
But it was here that you got this
the troop commander, a young captain, I'll say young, he was a regular officer anyway, not a national service officer, because we did have a mix. We had some national service officers. Under a socialist government, they wouldn't allow the national service system to be run solely as of a rank. They insisted that there was access to commission to it. And this chap is a regular officer, nice young bloke, but gung-ho and everything. And he got the system of reports where, for senior ranks, your unit commander makes out a confidential report on your performance throughout the year, your abilities, and also your in the artillery's case, the troop, who's normally a captain, makes out an employment report as well, each of which you see and you sign. You can object to signing it and protest, and it goes to the colonel whether he reviews it. In this case, with the employment report, he gave me a wonderful report about my military abilities, but concluded it with inclined to be bolshy when things go wrong, which I objected to and wouldn't sign it, so consequently it came in front of the colonel. And my objections were, as I stated to the colonel, how could you call me a conchie with all the service I've given during the war? And as far as things going wrong, I had every right to be upset things went wrong, because they shouldn't go wrong. Colonel agreed with me entirely and made him apologise to me, and it was stricken from the record, yeah.
Did he try to take it out on you after?
No. He was, you know, he realised he'd overstepped the mark. So the greatest of relationships, really. No way in the world.
Can I just go back to Egypt? Was that a popular posting or unpopular with the troops there in the 53-55 period?
Unpopular, especially with the National Service lads. I thought they were terrific under the conditions, really. To be sent on these, they'd be put on a train, say, from down from Suez down to Fayed, just to guard a train on their own. What could they do if things went wrong? There's no one to tell them what to do anyway, you know. Things like this, trucks, set up on his own on a truck. It wasn't as though they were a unit doing it, you know. I think, and I've actually, as orderly sergeant, regimental orderly sergeant, be his responsibility to ensure that these men went on the right time to do the particular job. And I've actually been waiting for some of them to come off of in from one job to tell them that they were on another escort duty. Rush away and get a meal and go, you know, which is the greatest of respect for them, really. And I think as a unit we were lucky, we had very little trouble. from them. Very, very few garden cases.
How much danger was there in the canal zone at that time?
Who can tell with the Arab nations? One could say that we had no, the regiment itself, time I was with them, only had two or three incidents of where some casualties. But who's to say that we couldn't have had more?
What happened on those incidents?
One was on outside the main camp. We had a sanger in the road. We were right on the perimeter wire, actually, of Moasca. A wog ambulance gone up as an ambulance, come by, and a burst of fire, and the chappie in the sanger was hit. He wasn't killed, but he was hit with one of these bullets.
Fired from an ambulance?
Yeah. and this is typical of the Arabs. You can't put any trust in them, really. Under the situation they were in, they looked upon us that we were occupying their country. Another one, he was shot from outside the perimeter. Guy not killed, but he was in the lookout tower and was a shot from outside the perimeter, and he was wounded.
So nobody was ever caught?
No, Tom, you got outside. We were in a wire campaign, you know, down at double apron, down at wire, only the main gate to go in and out. Tom, the patrol got reins of them, or the guard, Tom, the guard got reins. You wouldn't have found anyone at all. So.
Now, I think in 56 that you got somehow involved in the war between Israel and Egypt.
Yeah, as I say, we had this detached battery in Jordan, which started off as a six-month posting from Egypt. But when we had moved to Malta, obviously 6 months, it was far better for the authorities to make it a 12-month station to save the expense of transporting up and down. When we were in Egypt, we used to take our own guns up by LSD, exactly as though it was a normal operation. But from Malta, we went in a troop ship and swapped guns. They sent an advance party down to us. We sent an advance party up there, took over the equipment, and then the troops were brought by a troop ship. We went up in the... our battery went up and were the first ones to go up on a 12-month posting in the March or April 66. I think it was March 66 for a 12-month posting. So we got up there, and it's a terribly hot station. They've got a, they had a, I've got my family with me now, with me in Malta. Egypt, we couldn't get them there. There was a shortage of quarters, so that was a separation. But when I posted to Malta, you didn't have to rely on the army for a married quarter. You could get a private hiring from the Maltese market, rent market, and bring your family out and live in a private rented accommodation, which I did. But when we come to go up to Jordan, obviously there were married families coming back to Malta, so we had an allocation of empty married quarters to go to. So I took my family, which was a wife and three children by now, to Malta, to Aqaba. But because of the heat, from July, they evacuated families with any child less than 3 years of age. Because of the heat, they evacuated them to Cyprus normally, or when we were in the canal zone, our families came to Egypt, back with the regiment, until the end of the hot season. So in July '56, my family, and all our families with children under three, came back to Malta, where the RHQ was. I flew back with them as an escort. Copped a nice month's leave out of it, and went back in the August back to Jordan. And the actual fact was, at that stage, there was a threat of us going back into the canal zone. Under the treaty, we could go back, the British Army could go back into the canal if the freedom of the canal was threatened in any way. Nasser was kicking up, so that it was touch and go where we went back. Nasser himself, we had no excuse from going back in. And they had, they used to call it the milk run flight, the RAF run troop passenger service from Malta across to Tripoli, Benghazi, Tobruk, because we had units in Tobruk and Benghazi then with the Libyan government. We had a treaty that they were still there. Across to Cyprus, Cyprus across to Egypt, Abaswa aerodrome, which we went from Abaswa across the Sinai to Aqaba. And me and the sergeant out of the 10th Hussars, they were tank regiment that was up in Jordan with us. His family had gone back, so he'd gone back and had a month's leave. They wouldn't, RAF wouldn't accept married families where they had an escort other than their crew in case of survival. If the plane crashed, they wanted army, preferably senior ranks there, to act as survival for the passengers, like families. And we got to Cyprus on this milk run, got down to go across to Abaswa, and the flight was off. Nasser wouldn't give us permission to land. This was a flight that was due to leave at 7 o'clock in the morning. So we just waited around Nicosia Airport. And finally, about 11:30, we took off to land at Abaswa and to be greeted by an escort of the Egyptian soldiers, huddled into a hangar. there were Valletta aircraft, 32 passengers they carried. Mostly these were National Service boys going back to up to Aqaba postings. We kept in this hangar about 3 or 4 hours and then marched out again and put on the plane and laid to go. Through the cracks in the hangar, we could see the Egyptian Air Force practice and take off with MiGs. At the end of the aerodrome, they had this huge pile of sand. So if they didn't make it, they burrowed into that. This is all part of the gradual build-up to the Suez affair. So we took off, and again, the normal thing was to go down the Gulf of the Suez and go back up the Gulf of Aqaba, the flight. But he wouldn't allow this. He'd given them a flight plan across the Sinai, which is quite a bumpy trip in the old bloody Valletta, you know, really. got back to the unit, and the flap was on there even more. It's in as much as that they were preparing to evacuate the families that weren't normally evacuated, didn't have children over under the age of three. I think within about a fortnight they were evacuated, and they went to Malta as well. And then, whereas we'd been stationed there all these years, the regiment had one troop, just 6 guns, now 12 guns. There was never any laid down operational plan as where you would deploy to in the event of anything happening. The reason we were there was to guarantee Jordan against Israeli invasion. Not that the Israelis were likely to press that way, you know, and things. But by now they realised that they would have to get some sort of operational plan out. We had we were a composite battery. Not only did we have 40 mm like axe, we had troop 25-pounders as well that we would man in the event of anything going up. North of Akbar is a huge salt plant. These are flats, they call it, and the operation now explained to us was that in the event of anything happened, a paratrooper mob would fly in and land on these flats. And a troop of 25-pounders would go up in defence of them. But we're now talking about end of August, and the sergeant's mess looked right across the valley to Israel, Eilat, and the border wire is about 2 miles away, and we could sit on the veranda at night drinking as you would, you know, because of the heat. And this night we sat there and there were no lights on in Eilat, and we all thought they had a power break. But about early hours of the morning we could hear these heavy engine aircraft overhead. No, they sounded as though they were actually over Jordan, no 2 ways about that. And the next morning we deployed to gun positions to defend the port of Akbar itself. The 12 guns were in a perimeter around it. my position was about 50 yards from the Israeli wire. Guy National Service boys, who blatantly said that the if the Israelis come our way, I'd be on my own. Well, they could see this side of the wire, just camel scrub, and the other side of the wire, crops being grown. So they began to sympathise with the Israelis that had far more moral right to the land than the Arab, as they saw, sat under a palm tree. Just wiped them the flies away, you know. I don't think for 1 minute that it would have been so. The battery commander, I hope he's not somewhere in these memoirs, wouldn't he? I didn't get on very well with him. He came down on this site to have a look the morning of the deployment, and he walked into the pit and he said, we got our backs to the wall, Sergeant Duncan, there's no way out. You know, that was a nice thing to come and say in front of these National Service boys who'd already told me that they weren't going to fight anyway, you know. I broke the ice by saying we're only about 100 yards from the water anyway, the Gulf. I broke the ice by saying, I don't know about you, I can bloody well swim. One of the national boys says, so can I. And that morning, that was an amazing thing. When we did wake up, there was an Israeli destroyer laying out off of Eilat. It had gone all the way around Cape Town, and it was there bang on the dot when we were there the night before the practice run for these heavy engines with the Israeli paratroopers dropping down on Egypt. So we had a grandstand view of the paratroopers dropping for the Mitla Pass, and the Egypt border from Israel was about 4 miles down the Gulf, and a storming party from this destroyer went ashore in New Egypt. But it was quite obvious that the Israelis were only going one way, they weren't coming our way. They're going Egypt way towards the canal zone.
Did it seem impressive?
Yeah, we were really impressed, because also we saw coming down the valley a continuous stream of a convoy, not a military convoy, because you couldn't call it a military convoy. The Israelis had commandeered every vehicle they could coming from Syrian Heights, because they had all deployed against Syria as well, and they'd given them a tank, and then they'd come down the valley to have a go at Nasser, like, you know, and they reached the canal in about 4 days, didn't they?
So yes.
We were really impressed by this. Now, the within a week we were back, they realised that the political situation, no, more than a week, about a fortnight, because the Labour government had kicked up. The Yanks had stormed through our invasion fleet that invaded Suez itself. The Yankee 7th Fleet sailed through our invasion fleet, and the Yanks sort of pulled a bomb on us and said, so everything come to a standstill.
Where were you during the actual fighting in the Suez War?
Deployed on the Israeli border in this scum pit, like, under the same conditions as we would be in a Lodak Act position during any wartime, living there, cooking alongside. You had your own cooker and everything. Rations was brought down to your water. And just sitting there waiting, you know. I just say we practice and gun drill and things like this, you know. Lining up on any aircraft that came down for a bit of practice.
Was there any hostility from the Jordanian authorities because of the attack on Egypt?
Yeah, there was a little bit, but right down on the wire, I didn't see any. Up in Aqaba itself, where some of the gun positions were, there was a bit of demonstration, but nothing, no violence happened at all. In fact, the whole time that they were in Jordan, the British troops, there wasn't one casualty. There was only one casualty from the Jordanians, and that was a captain out of the service corps who acted like a bloody idiot. And he's married quarter. This was about the same time. The families have been evacuated out of the quarters, but apart from the incidents of the actual when we deployed, the heads of family still lived in the married quarter as a guard on it, so that the Jordanians didn't get in and loot it and that. And he was in his quarter, and he from his quarter he could see the ordnance compound surrounded by barbed wire, and he saw a wagon outside the wire and some Jordanian or Arabs loading tyres over out from the Waskar. So he went to the HQ, which was only about 50 yards from his quarter, grabbed a vehicle, went down himself with a revolver to challenge these. Didn't take anyone from dressed in white, civilian shorts and shirt. The truck saw him coming and they headed towards Akbar itself and pulled into Akbar. He pulled up outside, the truck was stopped, and he approached them himself. The lad in was still in the Land Rover. There was a shot, and the lad said he saw this officer point the revolver and fire into the cab. And then there was a fusillade of shots from Akbar itself. He dropped, and the driver did the sensible thing, beat a retreat back to HQ. When they went down there, there was no one to be found, but the captain with a span of 17 bullet holes in the back of his back. That was the only incident. He'd asked for himself. No way to go and challenge him. Particularly is because the mayor of Akbar itself told the camp commandant that they thought he was a Jew. What do you bloody argue, you know? They themselves, the Jordanians, were very, very friendly towards us, other than when the actual Israeli war started, because for about 3 months before that, Nasser, through the Egyptian radio, had stirred the old Middle East up anyway. But apart from that, no. In fact, after that, the Jordanians abrogated the treaty, broke the treaty, said they gave us 6 months to get out. In the evacuation of it, the 10th Hussars were sending the party home on a Valletta, which crashed, and it crashed up in the desert. But there happened to be a Jordanian army unit there on exercise, who some of them showed great bravery in trying to get the troops out. They all perished.
What did you personally feel about the action of the British government in intervening in the Suez Crisis?
At that time, because as I've said previously in this interview, I was aware that we could go back into the canal zone in the event of it being threatened. So the way I looked upon it, that it had been threatened with the Israelis attacking it. But afterwards, of course, it was exposed that there was a collusion with the Israeli. And it had to be, when you look at it, that we had the invasion force there ready at exactly the same time, you know. Had they come my way, I would have done a go. There's no two ways about that. I sympathised with the Israelis, but not enough that I would have not carried out my job.
Now, can you tell me how you came to be in the Australian Army?
Yeah. We...